I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole.
And before we start the old mole, let me tell you that this KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice, activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO FM in Portland, Oregon. The show that takes its name from Karl Marx's description of the subversive forces of revolution that continue working underground even when overt political conditions seem darkest. The Old Mole digs deeper into the meanings of our political, social, and cultural world. The labor of moles on today's show delves into challenges to authority and the search for alternative ways of living, freedom and equality, democracy and solidarity, criticism and creativity. My name is Fran Michelle, and I'm your host this morning. Our engineer is Kate Welch. Later on today's show, Bill Resnick will be talking with Ellen Willis, author of No More Nice Girls, Countercultural Essays, Beginning to See the Light, Sex, Hope, and Rock and Roll, and most recently, Don't Think, Smile, Notes of on a Decade of Denial. Denise Morris will have a commentary on Critique from a Mole's Perspective, and then Denise and I will be reviewing the 2004 documentary The Take, written by Naomi Lewis and directed by Naomi Klein and directed by Avi Lewis, and recently released on DVD, a study of worker-controlled factories in Argentina. But first, it's time for the Well-Read Read. Tomorrow is the 4th of July, on which Americans commemorate the signing of the Declaration of Independence, that document that states, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness." Of course, by men, the signers chiefly meant white men of property. They did not extend the rights of liberty to slaves, nor to indentured servants, nor to Native Americans, nor to women. Independence Day is a double-edged holiday for progressives. On the one hand, we are acutely aware of the failures of the United States to live up to the ideals inscribed in its founding documents. On the other hand, we want to claim the radical potential embedded in those ideals. In 1852, the author, activist, and escaped former slave Frederick Douglass was invited to speak to a group in New York on the 4th of July, and he asked, "What, to the American slave, is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him, more than all the other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity, your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless, your denunciation of tyrants brass-fronted impudence, your shouts of liberty and equality hollow mockery, your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgiving, with all their your religious parade and solemnity are, to him, mere bombast, fraud, deception, and hypocrisy. Whether we turn to the declarations of the past or to the professions of the present, the conduct of the nation seems equally hideous and revolting. America is false to the past, false to the present, and solemnly binds herself to be false to the future." Further, Douglass observes that the complacent celebration of the past can obscure the significance of the present. Quote, "To say now that America was right and England wrong is exceedingly easy, but there was a time when, to pronounce against England and in favor of the cause of the colonies, tried men's souls. They who did so were accounted in their day plotters of mischief, agitators and rebels, dangerous men. To side with the right against the wrong, with the weak against the strong, with the oppressed against the oppressor, here lies the merit, and one which, of all others, seems unfashionable in our day. The cause of liberty may be stabbed by the men who glory in the deeds of your fathers. As Douglas suggests, the celebration of revolution paradoxically comes to serve the interests of reaction. That we were once a group of colonies seeking separation from the empire today obscures the fact that we have become the imperial empower ourselves. The full speech by Douglas is available on the website historyisaweapon.org. As Douglas notes, we have to do with the past only as we can make it useful to the present and to the future. In his collection of writings titled Thinking About the Longstanding Problems of Virtue and Happiness, the playwright Tony Kushner outlines a past made useful, laying claim to an American political tradition which is, quote, mostly an immigrant appropriation of certain features and promises of our Constitution and of the idea of democracy and federalism. This appropriation marries freedom, up for grabs, morally and ideologically indeterminate freedom, to the more strenuous, grave, and specific mandates of justice. It is the aggressive, unapologetic, progressive tradition of the 1930s, a tradition strongly spiced with socialism, trade unionism, and the ethos of internationalism and solidarity. This past week, the organization U.S. Labor Against the War has called for action from those of us who believe in internationalism and solidarity, as well as liberty and justice for all. In an article posted to ZNet, they report that, quote, the Iraqi regime has frozen the bank accounts of Iraqi labor unions under Decree 8750, adopted in 2005. The decree gave Iraqi authorities the power to seize all union funds and prevent them from being dispensed for union activity. To justify the 2005 anti-union decree, the regime used the pretext of promising a future law to regulate trade union organizations and their activities. No law recognizing and respecting labor rights was adopted. Decree 8750 is still in effect. The election of a government has changed nothing. In 2004, the occupation's then proconsul in Iraq, U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer, declared trade union activity in the state or public sector to be illegal by continuing to enforce Saddam Hussein's 1987 Law 150, banning unions in the state sector by declaring public employees to be civil servants rather than workers. Law 150 also continues in effect. From day one of the occupation, the U.S. has aimed to put Iraq's vast oil resources and all its public enterprises, most of its core economy, in the hands of multinational corporations through direct privatization or through production-sharing agreements. The labor movement in Iraq is one of the most effective opponents of this policy. In October 2003, union activists forced KBR out of oil industry workplaces. KBR had been given a no-bid contract to get the oil industry back into production after the invasion. If Iraq is to develop a real democracy with full participation of all its citizens without regard to religious affiliation, ethnic group, tribe, or gender, a free and independent labor movement is critical. No democracy can exist without one. The U.S. and the government it created cannot claim to be for democracy while attempting to strangle Iraq's labor movement. U.S. Labor Against the War asks social justice activists to protest the Iraqi regime's interference with and harassment of Iraqi unions that are fighting to defend the rights of Iraqi workers in their workplaces and the interests of Iraq's working people in society. Write to the Iraqi government and demand that union bank accounts be unfrozen, that Saddam Hussein's Law 150 and Decree 8750 be annulled, and that labor rights be immediately recognized and fully respected in Iraq in accordance with internationally accepted International Labor Organization standards. Send your protests to the government of Iraq, care of their embassy, 1801 P Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20036, or via email to admin@iraqiembassy.org. More information can be found at zmag.org. For the Well-Read Red, this is Fran Michel, wishing you a happy Interdependence Day. That was Annie DeFranco and Utah Phillips, fellow workers performing the Internationale. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on listener-sponsored KBOO-FM, community radio in Portland, Oregon. Later on today's show, Denise Morris will have a commentary on criticism from a mole's perspective, and she and I will be reviewing the documentary The Take, a study of worker takeovers of factories in Argentina, written by Naomi Klein and directed by Avi Lewis. Next up, Bill Resnick interviews progressive journalist Ellen Willis about, among other topics, the usable past and the persisting legacy and lessons of the 1960s.
Ellen Willis, welcome to KBOO.
Oh, nice to be here, Bill.
Ellen Willis is director of the program on cultural reporting and criticism in NYU School of Journalism. Her latest book is Don't Think Smile, Notes on a Decade of Denial. She's a wonderful writer, an engaged intellectual, often found on the libertarian left, arguing against those who would downplay the rights to freedom of emotion and thought and sexuality, and even for teens and of course, for sexual minorities. She's always ready to fight for the right to less work and more pleasure. She's a proud, unrepentant radical and argues that that's the right position for the left. Ellen Willis, you defend the 60s, that 60s changes were not just good for most people, not only made enduring changes in so much of life, but should be fought for and fought for by the left and extended. Why have you been pushed to take these that position, this unrepentant radical position, and how have you done it?
Well, and by the way, I think like less work and more pleasure is like a really good bumper sticker. I would like to have that.
Of course, you can like your work too. It seems to me that's even a better one. Find work you love, not so easy.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. Really, sort of ever since the rise of the religious right in the late 70s, and, you know, sort of particularly after Ronald Reagan's election in 1980, I think that the left has been running full tilt against any kind of association with the utopian liberationist impulses, you know, for which the 60s are shorthand. It's like they're not just the 60s, you know, but something that has been going on really since the late 19th century, you know, particularly cultural radicalism flowered in the years before the First World War, and the 60s is really a second wave of this movement. But sort of with the conservative backlash, basically a large portion of the left has sort of decided, and it kind of became a kind of conventional wisdom, that the 60s were sort of really this kind of weird hallucination from which we all simply needed to recover, that cultural radicalism was either there was a sort of contradictory idea that sort of on the one hand, cultural radicalism was bad and it sort of had a malign influence on the left and sort of had strengthened the right because it really went against most Americans' values. And at the same time, the insistence that cultural radicalism was trivial and hadn't accomplished anything at all. And of course, I don't think either of these things are true. I think this is a kind of historical revisionism. I think, in fact, the 60s had such a major impact that we are all living with its changes so much that a lot of them have been integrated into mainstream culture and are simply taken for granted. And I think sort of everything from, sort of what the 60s counterculture did was put freedom and the quality of life and the idea, the importance of finding pleasure in life as political issues, you know, sort of in every way ranging from challenging a repressive sexual morality to styles in dress and music.
Mm-hmm. Some of it, though, some of it wouldn't even be seen, though, so much as radicalism. In fact, even the attack on, I mean, the attack on male violence, the change in child-rearing patterns to far more nurturant, less repressive behavior. In some ways, it's of course very radical. Even the democratizing family, where people, when kids are young, start giving them choices and try and involve them. It seems to me it's of course a joke in some ways, and it's seen as very funny. But in fact, it's moved throughout the classes. It's sort of the conventional wisdom that you shouldn't really hit kids, maybe an occasional potch. All those things, it seems to me there's a real democratizing and much more respectful trend and real changes in authority.
Yes, I mean, you know, definitely there was a critique of the authoritarian family and sort of an opening up of what was acceptable in terms of less rigid familial patterns. And, you know, of course, feminism, you know, it's like a worldwide cultural radical movement that sort of had an impact, you know, sort of not only in all corners of American society, but throughout the world. That people don't even remember now a time when sexism was not considered a problem, but was simply taken for granted the way things were.
Yeah, male superiority was just assumed. It was part of
openly promulgated. And, you know, I think the great achievement of the 60s social movements in terms of both sex and race, it's like neither sexism nor racism has been eliminated, but both were put on the forefront of the agenda as problems, so that the caste system of the South and sort of all its other emanations, you know, sort of throughout our entire society, was challenged, you know, on all levels, like economic, political, and cultural, and, you know, so was the entrenched male supremacy. It wasn't just like a matter of equal pay for equal work, but it was inequality sort of everywhere, you know, from the workplace to the bedroom to the street. And even though these inequalities are far from solved, it's like the fact that they've become a matter of contention that nobody can ignore, and has led to an enormous amount of progress sort of relative to what existed before.
Sexuality has so changed from my day. It's somewhat astounding, actually, if you think back and you put yourself in the position of, which often I do, because sometimes I'm sort of shocked when I walk down the street, because it's my 12-year-old, you know, socialization that's sort of there. And it's sort of shocking, and then I find it wonderful. But that gays and lesbians are now able to fight to be, I mean, they've in fact won the fight in lots of places not, to be able to show affection in public, which would have been 50 years ago so shocking one couldn't, you know, it was unimaginable, is my guess, when I was a kid, how my parents would have responded if something like that was happening in front of them and their kids. It was, you know, just an impossible thing to do. And that the demands now for sort of marriage and for respecting rights to sexuality or sexuality for older people, it seems mm-hmm. to me, and in fact women's rights to pleasure and recognition of sexual pleasure for women even. I mean, that was sort of tabooed, but you could sort of get away with it in the 40s or 50s. It seems to me those things are just enormous, enormous changes in people's daily lives and their expectations for their lives.
So a lot of the response of the left to all this is to sort of say, well, we won, let's go home. Sort of rather than keep on contesting as conservatives try to roll back these rights. And again, I think you're sort of dealing with a whole world historical movement that can't ultimately be rolled back, but people can be made pretty miserable by the attempts to roll it back in the meantime. And I think that the right has gotten, the cultural right, well, and the economic right as well, because I think they're intertwined in ways that the left also often doesn't recognize, has gotten far more traction and influence far out of proportion to its numbers, and, you know, intimidating many more people than really agree with it deep down, because there's been fundamentally a vacuum of opposition.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like the left has kind of been in appeasement mode.
Yeah, you've written that actually that people are ambivalent, though, and that gives the right this great opportunity. They're ambivalent about a lot of the new freedoms. They're certainly ambivalent about, and a lot of men are resistant, even as they move a little. They would like to not be forced to move more. People are sort of undermined by their, it seems to me, by, in fact, fears of losing control. All of us need control in sexuality and almost everywhere else. There's a way in which we somehow maturation requires us to somehow be able to, and we're afraid of losing control. It seems to me one of the arguments you made is that the right has taken advantage of that. How do you see that?
Yeah, so I mean, I feel like there's sort of a deep layer of sexual guilt that we've all grown up with, which has to do with the influence, you know, sort of fundamentally of authoritarian religion on everybody's life. I don't care how secular you are. It's just like deeply ingrained in the culture that our desires are bad and suspect, our sexual desires and our desire in general, and also particularly if women start acting on their own desires, this is kind of going to be the end of civilization. It's like only anarchy can possibly result from this. There's a sort of deep lack of confidence, and I think most of this is on a fairly unconscious level, you know, that we could ever really have like an alternative democratic morality. You know, there's like this feeling that with more freedom, just all hell is going to break loose. And there's a certain grain of truth in that also, in the sense that when we start challenging traditional institutions, it's sort of much easier to challenge authority than to find the alternative ways of living to replace it. And so, you know, I do think, you know, there was a lot of turmoil in the 60s, you know, sort of as well as the good things it accomplished. I think people did feel like a lot of the time that things were falling apart. I mean, relations between women and men, there was sort of all this anger and anguish coming out, and sort of what was this going to lead to. So, you know, I sort of do think it's scary. But I think the struggle to find alternative ways of living is like very important and should not be abandoned because of the scariness of it.
This is the Old Mo Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mo, talking to Ellen Willis, a proud, unrepentant, cultural radical standing up for the right to pleasure and freedom, and attacking not only the right but also those parts of the left who argue that we should somehow back off on our support for young people, gays and lesbians, teen sex, reproductive rights. They argue they should back off. Ellen Willis argues that, in fact, we have to be proud of our gains and, in fact, try and extend them. Ellen Willis, let's talk about the sort of, you mentioned an alternative democratic morality. It seems to me cultural radicals have not done very well at trying to talk about that. There's this, I mean, a diminishing group, but still there's sort of this demand that we respect the desires of everybody for the kinds of sexual satisfactions they want. We have to, in fact, give artists the room to often be extremely offensive and blasphemous. I mean, we sort of make but the side of the sort of the alternative democratic morality. What do we say about how, in fact, we the efforts for expression and sexuality? How do we sort of fuse them into a kind of democratic style of human relations and be able to promote that? Sorry for this somewhat incoherent question. Maybe you can make sense of it.
Well, I think that what cultural politics is really about is identifying the obstacles to new ways of living. That is, people try to find a different way of living and run into social opposition, you know, sort of whether it's people trying to live together communally or, you know, sort of women trying to demand equal relationships, sort of whatever the rebellion is against what's going on, they sort of run into opposition, and this sort of then becomes political, kind of exposing how the social system is preventing people from experimenting and trying to find their way to something new. But politics itself will, like, not give you the answer to what then to do. You know, I feel like cultural politics is about making space for social experiment, and sort of only through social experiments and through trial and error and success and failure, you know, that people will find new ways of doing things. It's not, you know, sort of something you can make a social blueprint about. And I think where cultural radicals have often run into trouble and turned into their own brand of cultural authoritarianism is in trying to make liberation into a prescriptive thing. Like, you know, with feminists, originally the slogan, the personal is political, basically was sort of trying to call attention to the fact that matters of personal life that were making women unhappy were sort of not just their private matter, but sort of reflected a larger social problem. Problems in marriage were sort of not just your marriage was unhappy, but your marriage was unhappy in particular ways that were being replicated by a lot of other people. But then a lot of people sort of seized on this phrase, the personal is political, to mean everything that you did in your personal life could be judged politically, you know, which was not simply you had the freedom not to wear makeup if you wanted to, but you shouldn't wear makeup if you were, like, going to be a good feminist.
Right, all kinds
that
of adornment.
That extrapolated to you shouldn't sleep with men, or right. You should do this, or you should do that. And I think what that shows is just how authoritarianism is, like, so ingrained in our whole culture that, you know, so-called cultural radicals are, like, by no means free of this.
Mm-hmm.
And that...
Well, yeah, you're sort of resisting my call for a left morality, but let me give it be more specific. How about just sort of the ethic of you have a lot of right, I mean, experiment and experiment and experiment, but also sort of you have to respect the people you're experimenting with, some sort of very basic, you know, some kind of interpersonal morality that would, in some ways, it seems to me, respond to people's fears of experimenting with kind of new, either sexual or expressive practices or ideas. It seems to me some sort of sense that you don't take advantage of others, you try and be honest. It seems to me that we can sort of promote those kinds of values. You don't hurt others intentionally. Is that a possible basis? I mean,
I feel like most people sort of across the board of how, you know, the political spectrum would sort of subscribe to those kinds of basic ethical values, but it's so much as sort of in the way you carry it out, you know, sort of again, you know, it's not like conservatives sort of don't believe in treating each other respectfully, right? But if you have sort of an institutional mm-hmm. situation where people are just sort of structurally unequal, then this corrupts the, you know, this, there are ways in which you will be treating people disrespectfully even if you don't want to. So to me, it's like politics is like about changing these structural things, and, you know, whereas there are certain sort of basic items of morality that are like simply that I think are shared by everyone. I think that a belief in democracy means fundamentally that a belief in freedom and equality as principles of human relations are necessary to a genuine achievement of your moral aims. So, like, maybe that would be the difference. Maybe that's what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. And
you know, a left morality has to be rooted in the idea that freedom and equality are fundamentally important values.
Ellen Willis, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Well, thanks for having me.
I look forward to your next book and essays. Keep up the good work. Thank you.
That was the Mekons performing Never Work from the album Escape from Memphis. You're listening to KBOO-FM, listener-sponsored community radio from Portland, Oregon. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour, the show that looks forward to the time when we'll have pleasure every day. And in the meantime, critiques the ways our world falls short of its possibilities and celebrates the steps that can get us closer to sustainable social and economic justice. We turn now to Denise Morris with a commentary on the nature of critique from a mole's perspective.
Why do we moles dig, burrow, tunnel, make mole hills out of mountains? Each week on the Old Mole Variety Hour, we try to answer that question by delivering programming that attempts to bring to the surface the revolutionary currents found in local, national, and international movements, film, music, media, fiction, and nonfiction. We believe that beneath the surface is a world of ideas suppressed, discredited, misunderstood, hungered for, necessary. This, we hope, is why you tune in each Monday morning, to get something not found in mainstream media. Now, we don't have a team of researchers. It's just us moles down here. Each mole's journey begins in search of answers to the questions begged by the day's subject. We dig, we Google, collaborate, and conspire. We do something else as well. We agree that in our programming, we will be committed to approaching our subjects with a politics that challenges capitalist ideology in its many forms. We are also committed to movement building and seek subjects that demonstrate people's great capacity for resistance and change. In the April 17th issue of The Nation, Ronald Aronson claimed, "The left needs more socialism." We agree. Aronson writes, "Successful ideological and political campaigns close up the space in which imagination might conceive of a world different from the status quo," end quote. We old moles want to open that imaginative space by using our access to radio media here at KBOO to offer alternatives. As socialists, we moles believe another better world is possible, one where capitalism's values of privilege, inequality, and power are replaced with fairness, equality, justice, and real grassroots democracy. Part of our commitment to the struggle against capitalism is keeping in perspective the importance of understanding the systemic nature of circumstances under capitalism. Again, from the left needs more socialism, Aronson states, we are all said to be equal politically and before the law, but socially and economically, our individual worth varies enormously. This is built into the American system. Social and economic inequality, a hallmark of life under free enterprise, make a mockery of a proud hallmark of American democracy, civil equality. On the old mole, we rarely place individual players, the quote-unquote bad guys, at the center of debate. When we do, we are most interested in how the actions or policymaking of those folks fits into the broader context of systemic exploitation and corruption, militarism and empire building. When we challenge them, we do so because we oppose their actions, which stem from an ideological investment in capitalism that results in policymaking aimed at protecting the interest of the wealthy at the expense of poor and working class people around the world, not to mention the planet. And speaking of the planet, I'll get to the point. Last week, Movie Mole's Angela Jones and I reviewed the film An Inconvenient Truth. Usually I have about one day I am able to dedicate to researching my portion of the programming. I am a mole for a day, if you will. Well, we saw the film on Thursday and spent the better part of the next 4 days researching this film and the man behind it, Al Gore. We were genuinely impressed with the documentary. We felt it was a very well-executed documentary with the potential to have an impact on the thinking of viewers around the world. We asked ourselves, who is this guy, and where was he in 2000? But we also asked, where are the corporations, and why are they missing? Neither Angela or I are fans of the Democratic Party. Perhaps you've heard the saying, the Democratic Party, where all movements go to die. We were aware of Gore's neoliberal policymaking, his support of the death penalty, his 2 degrees of separation from Bush during the 2000 election, and of course his utterly depressing behavior following the Supreme Court appointment of Bush to the presidency, a man nobody mistakes for a friend of the environment. Angela, my partner in this review, was a journalism major back in Kentucky and spent a number of years working for dailies. She is a voracious investigator and really opened the floodgates on Gore's checkered past, and I say also his present. We talked a lot about how to handle this situation. The internet is littered with Gore in 2008 websites. It was clear to us that Gore looks good to a lot of folks right now. And global warming? Imperative that people hear this message. So what's a mole to do? Sometimes it is the digging that sets the course for discourse. And for a journalist who knows all too well the consequences of digging up dirt where dirt is not wanted, the answer was easy. This is KABU. People will want to know. Well, some folks did want to know and were sad or disturbed or frankly not surprised. Others were upset that we exposed Gore and felt his actions were in the past and we must look ahead. This is not an uncomplicated situation. It raises questions about political strategy, ethics, responsibility. But for the moles who chose to dive in and open this can of worms, we ask, who do we want to speak for us on these most important issues? Who can we trust to do what is in our best interest to represent us fairly against the interest of global capital? Because this is what is destroying the planet. Al Gore is right to claim that already many of the consequences of climate change from CO2 emissions are irreversible. What is also irreversible are the consequences of policymaking by Gore himself over 3 decades in politics. Frankly, his environmental record stinks, and the damaging effects of his actions are here and now, right down to the pockets he lined, including his own. We dug deep and found evidence of grave deceit, hypocrisy, broken promises, and pandering. All of this well documented, including 2 books with another forthcoming. And as they say on the X-Files, the truth is out there. It's not a secret if we choose to stop whispering. Gore clearly has the capacity to act morally, as we all. His passion for global warming is evident. But should we accept the makeover without examination and call it good? These moles felt we could not. Part of Gore's message is we must hold government and corporations accountable. I couldn't agree more. See Al Gore and Apple Computer for a test of the Ozone Man's present-day principles, or perhaps his position on the invasion of Afghanistan, otherwise known as the Good War. Finally, it is Al Gore's commitment to free market capitalism that makes this mole believe that minor reform, a little behavior mod, and some wrist-slapping are the most we could hope for from a Gore presidency. Global free market capitalism will never be compatible with saving the planet, its people, or its species. We can do better. Alternatives must be thinkable. Could it be that we are that alternative? This is Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for listening.
It's a matter of passion. No, not the science fiction kind. It's all about ignorance and greed and miracles for the blind. The media parading, disjointed politics, founded on petrochemical plunder, and we're its hostages. If you stand and reason, you're in the game. The rules may be elusive, but our pieces are the same. And you know if one goes down, we all go down as well. The balance is precarious, as anyone can tell. This world's going.
That was Bad Religion performing Kyoto Now from The Process of Belief. You're listening to KBOO-FM in Portland, Oregon. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Fran Michel, and I'm here with my fellow movie mole Denise Morris to discuss The Take, a documentary written and directed by Canadian activists and journalists Naomi Klein and Avi Lewis. The recently released DVD is available at the Multnomah County Library, at independent video rental outlets around Portland, and through Netflix. The film explores worker takeover of factories in Argentina after the economic collapse of 2001. In particular, we follow the efforts of workers at the Forja auto parts plant, led by workers' cooperative president Freddy Espinosa and activist Lalo Perret from the Movement of Recovered Companies, to gain legalization of their expropriation of the plant. The film also takes place during the presidential race between Carlos Menem, who had presided over the financial collapse, and Nestor Kirchner, who has the support of old Peronists. One thing that the film maybe doesn't give us as much of as we'd like is background and history on Argentina. For those of us who are already familiar with that history and that story. But you did a little digging, Denise.
I did do a little digging, and I emphasize little. This old mole was a little taxed over the weekend. But I did find out some important things that I think the film does could have used to put in perspective. And I think that it may be common knowledge that Argentina is a former colony of Spain, and that colonization actually didn't end until 1816, which is a very relatively short period of time following a 300-year occupation. The film really does not cover a lot of ground in this area, and I will refer to an article that I thought was very informative, and folks could look for it if they were interested in doing some reading before seeing the film. And from ZNet, Daniel Mordukovic, I believe is how you say his name, wrote a really wonderful article. He was actually born in Argentina and spends quite a bit of time talking about the collapse, which we'll get to, which occurs in 2001, but also a little bit about the history, and I'll read a quote here. His opinion is that the film is flawed in this way as well, and that it would have helped bring perspective to folks to understand something about Perón in particular, and we'll get into the Perón regime later, or I guess presidency. But he says that, you know, the film barely mentions the brutal military dictatorships the country endured from the mid-50s to the early 70s, followed by the return of Perón, and then by the incredible murderous military regime that fought the Dirty War, where 30,000 people disappeared. Perón himself is far from the social democrat alluded to in the film. He started out as a military colonel, one of many Argentine military men who were largely Nazi sympathizers and, in fact, sought refuge first in Paraguay and then later in Franco's Spain after being deposed in 1955. He was known, and non-quote now, he was known as a champion for the working class, but again, Daniel points out, although his attempts to organize the working class were instrumental in instilling a sense of self-respect, and his government brought about a number of reforms and guaranteed the social safety net that helped create the country's famous middle class, he operated paternalistically, ultimately not helpful to the larger interests of this very same working class, organizing very corrupt unions, which were not in the self-interest of the that were in the self-interest of the union bosses. So this information it would provide context more importantly because the film really does explore the a sequence of electoral politics where people are really torn with their hearkening back, their nostalgia for the past, for the good old days, and Perón is really a symbol of that, whereas Menem, who is the man who presided over basically the selling of the country, deals with the IMF and the country's subsequent collapse, is kind of demonized by a strong majority of people, although he still had a number of supporters in the country.
Yeah, I mean, he even had support among some of the workers. One of the workers in the Fora factory says he's planning to vote for Menem, and you know his coworkers clearly think he's nuts for that he's making a big mistake. But one of the sort of motifs in the film around the election is that we see a young woman, Maddie, who's a worker at another one of the expropriated plants, the Zenon ceramics factory. And she's completely disaffected with electoral politics. You know, our dreams don't fit on your ballots. She's not going to vote. She's not interested in that. She's interested in this direct democracy, direct activism in her workplace. But her mother is campaigning for Kirchner and is an old, a big fan of Perón and has a picture of Evita hanging in her house. And so this mother-daughter conflict becomes kind of one of the sort of human face of this subplot about the election and the question of how much to put faith in electoral politics and how much to put faith instead only in this kind of direct democracy and the power of the people themselves.
Yeah, just sort of stepping back or rolling the footage back, the film opens with the discussion of the collapse of the 2001 December 2001 collapse of the country, and what we see are the streets flooded with people who have gone from living what seems to be a very lucrative and middle class life. In fact, credit cards became a part of people's lives before the collapse of the economy, which gave people a boost, were able to consume and build lives, and there really was this kind of real middle class that was in place. And we see these same people in their fabulous leather coats banging on bank machines because they've been locked out of their bank accounts. The country is completely shut down. There's a military and police presence on the street, but there's an incredible outpouring of resistance on the part of the Argentine people. And I think part of why the film's in a lack of historical context is critical is that there is a tradition of resistance in Argentina. So it makes sense that people come out. And there's also a real history of suppression, particularly around ideas of socialism, as happens throughout the world and Latin America.
Indeed. And some of the bonus features on the DVD really emphasize the bravery of the people in responding to and resisting some of that repression. But one of the things we get in the course of the documentary itself is the sense of the importance of community support and sort of the broad support among people for these factories, for the expropriations of the workers who are really claiming their rights. I mean, the grounds for taking over the factories, which have been abandoned by their wealthy owners, is that they've been built, the factories have been built up with taxpayer subsidies, you know, so that that there are the workers are arguing, we've already paid for this. We own this. This is ours now. And you're not using it. We're going to. So it's really fundamentally a challenge to private property. And you do get a very strong sense of the kind of bifurcation of the class system. There's an interview with the former owner of the Zenon ceramics plant, and it's just amazing. He's in this very sort of palatial-looking room, and there's a bottle of champagne chilling in the background, and he's insisting that it's, you know, he's built the plant, it's his work, and he's going to get it back. The government is going to give it back to him.
He's visited Menem in prison, and they've talked.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, that, you know, his reliance on the government certainly gives you a sense that that young workers like Maddie are, you know, it's perfectly understandable that they are completely disaffected with the role that the government plays. And yet, ultimately, I mean, to sort of give away some of the developments, the Fora workers succeed in part because of the support of the government in Buenos Aires, that finally they get a law passed allowing them to have the legal right to their factory. And so, I mean, there's a sense in which these elected officials, when they are sympathetic, at least at the local level, are in a position to help reinforce these kinds of changes. And it seems clear that if Menem had been elected rather than Kirchner, that the decisions would not have gone as they did in favor of the workers and in favor of supporting their right to run the factories themselves.
And the filmmakers enter Argentina at a time when there were 100 factories that were worker-controlled, worker-owned. There were also a number of schools, healthcare clinics that were restarted by people. And what the filmmakers were hoping was that they could get in on the ground floor of a factory, of an occupation of a factory, and experience the process of the workers going through the arduous task of restarting this and restarting it legally and all that. They felt like the possibility of that happening was about zero. So as they're working with, you know, what they said were about 20 different storylines, it happened. They got to see this happen. So they follow these workers for the auto parts factory through this process. And what we get to experience is seeing what is largely a great experiment in creating alternative economies that are from below, that bubble up from below. And Fran, one of your favorite sentiments about the film is this idea that when you're against something, it's real easy to kind of, you know, say, hey, I know what you're against, but what are you for? And when Naomi Klein and Ave Lewis were kind of faced with that question, they felt Argentina is the place we need to go because here is something that is happening.
Yeah, there's a clip of an interview that Naomi Klein did. Because she's known as someone who's campaigned against sort of capitalist globalization and the branding of the world. Her well-known book is called No Logo. And you know, a mainstream talk show host says, "Well, you're against all this stuff. What are you for?" And we hear her in voiceover saying, "You know, he wouldn't let me answer the question, but it was a good question." And what they're for is this sort of direct democracy kind of. It's a socialism from below, although they never label it in that way.
Another criticism that is leveled, but it's tough. Yeah.
I mean, there's a point when we meet workers from various worker-controlled factories, and one of the women from the Bruckman clothing factory, which is the first of the expropriated factories, says, you know, we're doing so well at this, we could run the whole country this way. And, you know, whether that is something that is fully spun out in the movie, it certainly raises a kind of hopeful possibility, the sense that people do, you know, we know what we're doing, people know how to organize their lives and can work through the problems of deciding how to run a factory and how to run the world.
And they're coming to consciousness through that process, because they came to having to take over these factories to out of desperation, because there are no jobs. So we get to see this evolution of consciousness in some ways, and it's an important, wonderful film.
And it's well worth seeing. So we recommend The Take, available on DVD.
To the schoolyard. Every evening I'm running home again.
Big thanks today to our engineer, Kate Welch, and thanks to our guest, Ellen Willis, Mole's Bill Resnick, and Denise Morris. I'm Fran Michel. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO-FM in Portland, Oregon.